Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Software Crafts podcast. Today with us we have Matt Lawrence, and Matt is the co-founder of the Digital Dynasty Design in Canada. Hi Matt, and thanks for your time to be with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
No problem. So today we have a long heuristic, and this heuristic has a name, but I'm going to leave the name to the end. And the heuristic is: users spend most of their time on other sites. This means that users prefer your site to work the same way as all the other sites they already know. This is also known as the Jacob's Law. What is your experience with this heuristic?
So funny enough, we actually we used to have a client in the very, very early days of digital dynasty design. And we this client used to work in the auto industry. And so his websites, because he had a few, were more or less, I would say, used as tools of the trade and less there for the design of stuff and having fancy headers and stuff like that. So his website was really old. And it was made on, I think it's called Dreamweaver. Yeah, Dreamweaver. That's the Adobe software. But he had, it was just a big mess. So, because it was very, very old. So we decided to redesign it. But one of the big asks at that time was, hey, you know, we can redesign it, make it look modern, make it so that it actually works on a phone. Because it was just really, really tiny in the top left corner of a phone. We need this site to look like and function mostly so that people who knew the old way of going through it can still go through it. And so a lot of his websites, because he had other websites as well, would be very similar in that way. And this kind of talks to this heuristic, at least I think it does, because the users were spending obviously their time on his website, but also parts websites, because it's cars. And so parts websites and sourcing other things, and they needed things to be more or less the same, and they didn't need any frills. You could modernize it and make it so that, hey, I can now look at this on a phone. But things that were really key to them were things such as the menus, the nav bar, which sounds very simple, but with cars, there's so many different things. And there was, I got to say, at least, I want to say 20 different menu options in the nav bar, obviously hidden in drop-down menus and such. But having that structure be virtually the same, if not the same, as the old site was super crucial. And then later on in the design, as we went through the pages, making the pages responsive so they would grow and shrink with the screen size, but ensuring that people understood or could use the site in a very similar or completely the same way as they used to was very crucial. And this, like I said, went on to their other sites as well. So obviously these workers were working on, you know, this guy's site as well as a bunch of other auto sites and stuff like that for their job. And having the having the experience be familiar to them from site to site and having it be familiar through site designs was very, very crucial. So I think it does speak to this heuristic quite a bit.
Yeah, and it's and thanks for sharing this story, right? Because I feel having an agency as you have, right? You need to balance all of these. And I'm your story, you were telling this story and a question pop up in my head, especially when you're talking about the nav bar and now the menu needs to be, right? That mm-hmm. is the context. So how do you discover the context of your customers so you can create solutions that fit their needs?
So that's a really good question. So I know that a lot of people will do sort of various programs actually on the various programs actually on the websites, like heat maps, and they have various pieces of data, like where are the people clicking, what's the UX type of thing. They're even taking feedback from live chat. But this was so, I guess you could call it grassroots. Excuse me. I guess you could call it grassroots. Realistically, what it was you would have, excuse me, of course, right when I started talking. But basically what happened was we would actually go to this individual's home, which was also his office. And we would have conversations where we would do small changes and do small things. And the person actually working on the site, since the site was so old, he would say, hey, you know, I'm trying to find this document to upload. I'm trying to find this blog post to upload. I'm trying to find this thing to change, and I can't seem to figure it out. So we would basically curate it just by talking to him, because he was the admin of the site, of the site's content for so long. We would curate it to him, and then he would go, because he was on the phone a lot with these people, with these different customers of his, and he would talk to them and they would give him feedback like, hey, you know, I really like, there was a job postings area. I really like the job postings area and I really like how it works. So let's not change that. But then there were other things like, hey, how many people are really using this program? And most people would say, look at the heat map of the clicks, or look at the data on that page and see, hey, there's only 5 users a month. But we, in this particular project, actually went to his house and spoke to him, and he would say, oh, you know, that was a government project that I provided some documentation for to register for, I don't know, some paint or whatever it was that they were working on a car. And that government project's been decommissioned or replaced. So we'd say, oh, okay, so this is an area where we can take a bit of a liberty here, and we can just more or less either hide this link in another drop-down menu, so there's a small change from the old version, or we can actually just straight up delete it completely.
It is very interesting, right? Because what I was jotting down is that you pretty much have conversations with people that use the system, or in this case, use a proxy, your customer, to nail down what is important, right?
Exactly.
Which is very interesting. And I think that as industry, sometimes we forget about that. We just think about efficiency and we forget that there are actually people using the software that we create. And thanks for this good reminder to keep talking with people to discover their needs.
Well, one thing too, I find as programmers, just to sort of add a sort of footnote to that is, and I do this a lot, is I'll be in, let's say I'm working on, I have a couple of Webflow projects at the moment right now, and I'll be working on a Webflow project and I discover either a new feature gets pushed to Webflow, or I discover a new feature, or I discover a better way to use it. And then I try to personally find it an excuse effectively to use that. And even if the user experience doesn't call for it, and I usually catch myself and I don't end up doing it, but sometimes, you know, as programmers, we like to play with stuff, or at least I do. And I find myself going in and being like, oh man, I know how to do graphs now. Can I do a graph on this site or something? And really that's not there for the UX. So sometimes that can add a bit of fluff and be sort of counterintuitive, or maybe just not even used in the UX of the actual user of the site.
Yep. Yep. That is also a really, really nice bridge, because I had another question when you were talking about how do you relate with heuristic, right? With your mm-hmm. this customer that the person was very keen to maintain the same structure. Is how do you balance a situation like that versus innovation, right? We know that UX and the way that we interact with different devices, we learn a lot, right? We create new ways to interact. We create new ways to push information. How do you manage that, right? You are opening the door, talking about you discover something with a Webflow, and then you try to find a use case to use it. But also, how do you bring this to your customers? Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, sure. So, for example, actually very recently, on one of these Webflow projects, we had a conversation where, we were going to be designing a bit of an expansion on a customer's website, and they wanted, this area to be basically, there was an interactive image. So when people clicked on certain areas of the image, they would receive, some information in some way. So they'd click on, you know, A, and they'd get all the information about the letter A type of thing. And What the back and forth was on the entire site was, the site needs to be really good for SEO. It needs to get a lot of organic traffic. We want this to be really easily readable and stuff like that. And that was on the base site. And then when the expansion was added on, we were talking about, like I said, this interactive image. And when you clicked on the certain areas, they wanted it to be in sort of a light box. So they wanted it, so you'd click on the letter A, and then a letter A like info box would show up in like a light box like you would have in a traditional image. And basically, I disagreed with that. And because of all the SEO considerations and stuff like that in the other in the other sections of the site. I kind of disagreed with that. So what I did was, is I said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to design, put make a design for individual pages. So basically you'd click on the letter A and it would go to an individual page, which I thought in this particular context was better for SEO. And I thought I'll make the page design such that it's pretty well modular. So I'm able to take this design and just put it into a lightbox of my making if I need to, rather relatively quickly. And I'm going to ship it to them with the individual pages and not with the lightbox, because there's no specific deadline on this particular objective. And I'm going to say to them, hey, this is, I've done what you asked here. I took a bit of a liberty with the individual pages. I don't even think I even mentioned that. I just said, hey, here you go. Let me know what you think. And then they ended up mentioning the lightbox and said, why is this different? And that gives me a bit of a stage or a forum, I guess, to have a conversation and say, the rest of the site was really all about SEO and we really wanted to hit certain keywords. And I really thought that this change into individual pages would have helped that SEO. But maybe you would prefer the lightbox. And if you do, no worries. I made it everything modular. So within a few days of actual work, I can just pop it into a lightbox and we can go from there. And that actually did open a forum. We had a brief demo period between the lightbox and the pages. And then we ended up going with the lightbox actually, but that's totally fine. It was worth having the conversation, worth having it, because obviously they took a number of days to get back to me because they were having internal conversations on, hey, what is the balance? And I think that those conversations are important, especially when a part of a site is an expansion and isn't on a strict deadline. I think getting it right, or as close to right, because it's not going to be perfect ever, the first time is really crucial when you have the luxury of time.
Definitely, definitely. And you, I think that you are also speak to a thing that is very close to me, right? That is a bit of design up front, not the mm-hmm. big design up front, but a bit of design up front, thinking about trade-offs, because the trade-off here was, do you want to optimize for SEO? That was a goal. Versus, do you want to do on this other way that will eat that own goal and have this candid discussion that allows people to think? And this is one thing that I'm starting to be more and more aware or seeing more and more in our industry as a whole, that people start to take more time to have these discussions and to really think through what are the trade-offs and consequences. Do you feel in the same way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm full of stories today, but we've had a project that we've been working on an ongoing basis. And there have been implications where in the beginning of the project, it was really, 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 really rushed. Like I can't stress that enough, very rushed. And there were times where I would, or the client would, or someone on the team would bring up and say, hey, this might fulfill the objective, and this might be okay, I guess, but I think this is going to have the implication of too many support tickets down the line, or too many user complaints, or confusion on the user's end. From a technical perspective, it's functioning, and if you read the documentation, you can get through it. But as we all know, users aren't going to read the documentation, or if you don't have proper organization and you have a lot of users, that's going to be a mess. And it ended up having implications even today, which is, I think, 2 years-ish down the line, where there's some systems where we just didn't straight up have time to do the fine tuning at the beginning. And so there's going to be implications possibly for the life of the product.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Because some of the consequences you cannot predict, right? We're using the example of the number of users inside of a company, right? That can vary, or even if the life cycle of the product, which is very, very interesting, that also is connected to your type of work, right? Because you work in a, if I can call like that, a web agency, right? So you are very project oriented, and now you are talking about products, right? So how do you balance between a project that has a beginning and an end, and a product where the life cycle can be totally different?
Yeah, so what we'll actually do is we'll have conversations, usually, or at least we try to, depending on timing and stuff, right off the bat. So for example, if we were to kind of compare and contrast from project to product that's ongoing. So with a lot of products that keep going, we will, and this has only happened like once or twice at this point, but we will try to usually either have a very clear cut agreement as to what's going to happen. So, hey, there's going to be the initial build out stage or the initial retrofit stage or whatever stage that it's in. We'll get it to the goal, which is usually like to launch it, or maybe it's like a version 2.0 of it or something like that. So then we'll say, okay, we're at version 2.0. Now what? Like, do you need our support? Do you need this? Do you need that? And if you do, this is how our support works. You know, we don't have a call center. We're not a huge business. So this is how this works. If you need, 24/7 support on all weekends, support at all hours of the day, this is how this works. This is who we would suggest, that type of thing. We'll try to sort of nail that down in the beginning. And then to contrast that to a project that ends, a lot of the time in web agency stuff, a lot of people they're not technical, and they've maybe never gotten a web project done before. And so the budget is obviously the biggest constraining factor. So what we'll actually do is we will stretch out a product into a project. So basically what we'll do is we'll say, okay, this is supposed to be a one-off site. You want a video game news website, just as a pure example. If you want a video game news website, it's going to cost you $10,000 and you only have three. So let's make a deal. Maybe we'll have a deal where you pay the three and you pay me on an ongoing basis, and we'll do the project in phases. So we'll get the MVP up first. So we'll actually build out the news section. You can get all that, but it won't have the best SEO. The next stage might be, let's fine tune the SEO, but we'll do that in a few months once I'm paid in the monthly installments. And then there'll be various stages, maybe 1 through 4 or something like that. Sometimes those projects actually end up becoming just straight up like forever or for the life of the project, because what'll happen is they get comfortable with effectively the subscription fee for my time. We have an agreed upon amount of hours and contact time and this and that. And basically they'll get comfortable with that. They'll like that. It's convenient for me because I know what to expect from them. And then we basically just work on an ongoing basis. So what I try to do a lot of the time is try to stretch out those one-offs in order to sort of get some passive income, which isn't so passive, but it's, I guess it'd be more reliable income than passive. And then it mitigates, because you were saying the agency life, it mitigates the sort of feast and famine that most agencies will experience in between projects. Bunch of projects, you got to turn half of them down. You finish the one project and now all of a sudden, oh, now we're, you know, now we're stuck. But if we can stretch those projects into products and keep them ongoing, then it eases that pain, if you will.
This is very interesting, because you are also touching in the business model. How do you balance all of these, right? To get the best out of that, right? Specifically, a revenue stream, right? Rather than have lots of spikes and dips and all of this type of stuff. And this is very interesting. I never thought in these terms, right? I work in other side of the software industry.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads me to this question. Where do you see the, let's call the web agency industry going? What do you see around? Because I see lots of tools popping up, right? Mm-hmm. Back in the day, you need to know all the code and all of these type of things. Today, we have lots of new tools popping out that in theory should make the life easier for creators. Where do you see the web agency industry going?
I would say a bit of a hybrid of chasing down sort of longer term projects, like I would just mentioned, and also doing sort of the one-offs as well. And the reason why I say that is because, so I, my business partner, Mike, he's more about the one-offs, or he'll work on an ongoing basis with like larger goals within the project. That's how I would break it down anyway. He might break it down differently, but basically he will, you know, he's not afraid to say, okay, Leno, let's do this for 3 months and then leave. And then let's do this for 2 months and then leave. And let's do this for 3 months. And I'm always the one trying to stretch it out. So the side effect of trying to stretch it out often is that sometimes the money gets out of whack. So because you're stretching it out for so long, sometimes it just becomes not enough income. It becomes a good sort of base once you get a few clients paying that monthly, but it is significantly less than the like the one-offs where they'll come in, they'll pay you 10 or 20,000 or whatever it is, and then you move on to something else. So, because like my $300-$500 a month will take forever to reach, you know, even $10,000. So, I think it's the reason why I say hybrid is I think it's just a good mix specifically in our context with myself and Mike is because he'll sort of pull me more toward, hey, you know, don't be giving them, you know, too, or don't be like, how would I describe this? Like, you know, don't be worried too much. Like they're paying us $300 a month, do $300 worth of work. And of course help them and do whatever, but we have to keep the bottom line in mind. Whereas me, I'm thinking, oh, like they've paid me. I don't consider the money. I just think like, oh, they've paid me. They're on this ongoing subscription basis. That's very comfortable. And so I'm, you know, I'll just do whatever. And so Mike's will like pull me more toward value, like more toward like keeping the money in the bank, if you will. And I try to keep like things sort of centered on, like I try to stretch things out. So he's more on bulk money is basically what I'm trying to get at. And I'm more on ongoing money, and ongoing money is obviously slower. So I think it's a hybrid of that where web agencies need to consider the long-term investment. It's almost like investing in real life. A lot of people will invest over time for retirement, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's various plans to do that, and I'm no expert, but there's like that sort of investment always in the background of your life. You constantly are investing and doing this thing, but in reality, you're really making money doing your day job. So that's kind of what's happening here is Mike's kind of doing the day job and I'm sort of doing almost the investing. So I think that that's actually really crucial when it comes to web agencies, because very, very recently, as we know with COVID and everything else, projects, products, everything are very tumultuous. Like there's very, let's go one day. And then all of a sudden it just gets shut down due to a lockdown or whatever. And we had a period of time, even this year, where the only income we had for a number of weeks or a number of months was just my passive income. So that kept us alive, but it also is like, okay, this isn't quite enough. We have to get something else. So I think the passive is really where it is, because it buys you time in those famine periods. It keeps you away from the panic of a $0 income for a month. It keeps you away from that panic. It also keeps you in the industry and keeps you doing things. But then it also like kind of even gets you in there. So like I'll find contacts and I'll like push them onto Mike. Mike will push some onto me, this and that. And it allows us to have sort of that hybrid. He's after the value. He's not afraid to move around. I'm after the solid, but smaller income, the passive income, if you will. And those two together, I think are really crucial to keep something like a web agency, at least in the last couple of years, the environment in the last couple of years alive. That's just my opinion.
And it's your experience, and thanks for sharing. I find this very interesting because I'm very attracted by technology and business models, right? And you are sharing your take how to run a small agency and keep it alive, right? So it's pretty interesting to tap into your knowledge. So we also can take this almost in the form of an advice for the listeners. And thanks for that. I think that is very useful. And talking about advices, what are other advices from an entrepreneurial point of view that you can give, right? Because you run your own show, you maybe learn one or two things around entrepreneurship.
Of course. Some stuff we learned as recently as 2-3 years ago. One big one that sounds super obvious, but always happens is, there's two of them actually. So I would say payment method and then hype. So first one I'll touch on, I guess, is hype. So don't buy into a project's hype. Make sure that you are being paid what you're worth and what you're willing to do. Sometimes you're willing to do something, you know, on a whim, like someone comes to you and says, I have this grand idea. It's going to dislodge Facebook and we're going to make millions here, but I have no money at the moment. Can you do this for free? Or can you do this for, you know, $100? Or can you do this for something that's much less? If you really believe in that project and you really want to go with that almost on a personal basis, or you think it's just going to be a great portfolio piece or something from an entrepreneurial standpoint, then of course go for that. But if you're just working sort of, if you will, on the everyday stuff and you're worried about the bottom line, the hype of a project really needs to take a back seat in the importance of a project that you accept. We've been caught so many times where we jump into a project where we get there and they're like, hey, you know, this will take 15 minutes a week. You won't be doing anything for us. It's no big deal. You know, 6-7 months later, we've worked for, or like one of us has worked for, you know, virtually full time or at least part time for $100 or something. And we're like, okay, we have to get out of here type of thing. So that's been a really big one. And on that as well, it ties into hype is payment method. So again, try to get what you're worth but in the method that makes sense. So for example, we've made partnership deals where we're on full commission, but on an untested market. But due to the numbers, it just makes sense. But we even went in and tried to be responsible and said, okay, here's the disaster scenario and the perfect scenario based on these numbers. And at the disaster scenario, we're not going to sink, so don't worry about it. And sometimes it'll go past the disaster scenario and go into a big disaster scenario and the project's still ongoing and you're just not getting paid that commission or you're not getting paid that amount that you'd need. So do the payment method that makes sense for you with the project and always take the numbers seriously that are given to you if you're presented with numbers like, hey, this is how we think this project's going to perform. But also really look at the disaster and I would personally focus on the disaster scenario that you have in your mind and even multiply that and say, hey, what if it goes beyond this disaster scenario? You know, where are we at? Like, are we liable for this? Are we this? Are we that? Where are we? So really keep in mind things like, does equity make sense? Does money up front make sense? Does commission make sense? Does a hybrid of those make sense? Does hourly rate, is that okay? Is just a one-time fee of $700 okay? And then we'll just finish the project. What is the amount that is okay with you? And a hybrid of those is perfectly fine. So just a real brief example, we worked on a project where we go to them, we say, hey, this is your MVP. We'll do this for $2,500. Okay. You know, things are signed or otherwise, or just agreed upon. And then you move forward, you do that. And then they'll be like, hey, we would like an addition while that MVP is in progress. We'll then talk to them and say, hey, that's an additional thing. And it's big. Usually if it's just like, hey, we want another social media icon, I'll just throw it in there, of course. But if it's something like, hey, we want a whole new poster generating system or something, then it's like, okay, that needs to be charged per hour. That's additional development time. And then you're getting your fair dollar for what you know what you're doing. And it really is crucial. Like going into something that, let's say you think is going to take 5 hours and you get paid, let's just say $100 an hour, so $500, and it ends up being 6 months of part-time work, is very bad for the bottom line. And we've been there. So really take a look at how you're being paid, look at the disaster scenario and really sort of determine, hey, am I going to be safe doing this transaction? Or, hey, am I really invested in this project and I don't care? I really just want to do it.
Really, really interesting. I really like how you put these components to manage risk pretty much. Mm-hmm. And you triggered me when you were talking about the payment methods. Of course, I understand the hype projects, right? Everyone has good ideas and is looking for someone to implement them. Mm-hmm. And we all have faced that. But with payment methods, you first talk about you are very aware of the type of markets, and you talk that even you took a different payment method when you went to an untested market, right?
Exactly.
How do you discover, what are your heuristics to evaluate a market?
A lot of it comes from our personal past. Lots of mistakes, to be honest. I know entrepreneurs say that a lot, like make mistakes. Yep, we've made mistakes. There's mistakes in progress right now, I'm sure. but yeah, make mistakes. There's things like a prime example is if you're working for, because we've done quite a few, or maybe two or three, I guess, at this point, government projects. And one of the things that like comes down to that, what we've learned is when we do a government-based project, we have to charge per hour. We've learned that in and out, because the government will be, they have lots of people. It's just, the time estimate will never be accurate in our experience. Just never, it never will be, just because there's lots of offices, lots of things to get signed and approved and stuff like that. And so hourly has to be the way. We've gone in and we've done other methods of payment, for example, and then just like worked it out. It's like, well, we got paid a dollar an hour or something here. You know, that's not great. Maybe we shouldn't have did that, that type of thing. So really, really, lots of mistakes, and lots of, customer feedback, but also different customer feedback. I think that's really crucial. So we do have certain clients where you'll get used to working with somebody, right? You'll work with somebody, they'll really like your work, and then they become a long-term client. And if they're a serial entrepreneur, especially, they'll put you on, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 sites and web apps and everything else. And you'll really like working with them. But it's important to not get bogged down in that one relationship, in my opinion. It's important to get feedback from other people, because some people will value the dollar differently. Some people will think, we were told by one guy, hey, you know, rent for an office, and this was maybe 5 years ago, rent for an office should be less than $500 a month. And I was thinking to myself, that's not right. Like, especially for this market, that's not right. Like, I know that it's more. I don't know the exact amount, but I know that it's more. And it's, and the reason why he had that opinion is because he was familiar with real estate. He did this, he did that, and he had a bunch of contacts. So he could find like, hey, this one business this one business has like a random office that's not in use because a manager is away, so I can rent it for $500 a month. But it's like, to us, like, we don't have that contact, we don't have that perspective, we don't have that information, so it's impossible for us to get that realistically, maybe without him. So the reason why I bring that up is it's really important to get opinions from everyone, because some people will say to you straight up, if you go to them and you say, hey, I need $100 an hour, they'll say, hey, well, my cousin does this for $40 an hour, $50 an hour. That might be the case, but that, you know, maybe his cousin's also being paid a commission on top and he's unaware. So getting price advice when you're looking at specifically customer feedback, really getting it from different places. We've noticed some places will scoff at $40, and some people won't even blink at $10,000. So it's just such a range of different scale businesses and different scale projects. And it really, really does take like a lot of feedback, a lot of trial and error, a lot of mistakes. And that's kind of how we came up with our parameters.
Very interesting. Thanks for sharing. I think that also there is a slogan here that might be printed in a t-shirt, that is, there are mistakes in progress. So I do think that this slogan should be captured.
Of course, yeah.
I really like it. Printing a t-shirt. I think that is entrepreneurial mindset 101. So this is a very fun and engaging conversation, but we are near to the end of this episode. And I have one last question to you, that is, for all of these topics that we have been talking about, and we went left, right, top down, whatever we could go. What are the resources that you recommend to the audience that they should read or listen or watch?
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, I would say I really like the, I think it's just straight up called the UX podcast. Let me just double check that. I put podcasts in a huge list on a queue. I listen to podcasts from everything. Yeah, UX podcast. I really enjoy the UX podcast. I find that there's good conversations there. I listen to podcasts in piecemeal. So that's just how I do it. I'll like watch a little bit here, watch a little bit there, do this and that. Specifically, if you want get a really interesting perspective. One episode that stands out on the UX podcast for me is called, it's number 235, which is Internet Anxiety with David Swallow. I listened to that a number of months ago, and it's a really interesting perspective on how certain design elements will, are designed to cause anxiety. And it's just a really interesting perspective. If you've ever booked a hotel at a booking site, I would listen to this. It's really interesting. It stands out in my mind when I make pop-ups actually now for newsletters and stuff like that. So I would check that out. In terms of the learning side of things, we're mostly, for the most part anyway, self-taught. But I would say Twitter is like a good, Twitter just in general is a good sort of place to follow. But if I was going into like specific basics, I would honestly say, I mean, people are going to come after me for this, but I really like using W3 Schools to learn the absolute basics. I use W3 Schools to sort of play in the little like playgrounds that they have. And I like using that. And really that's, I kind of jump around a lot between resources. So I don't have anything specific really to sort of suggest in that way, but really I jump around a lot. And I really like also like CSS Tricks as well, the website. I would say those three things, the UX podcast, W3 Schools, especially if you just want to play with the basics of a concept before kind of going in and doing more with it. And then also CSS Tricks as well. I always enjoy their articles and their perspectives and how they hack things around. Hey, we don't want to use JS here. We want to use CSS, or, hey, this is how we got this working with CSS, stuff like that. I use them for a bunch of stuff. So they're a great resource as well.
Cool. Thanks. I will make sure that these resources are on the description of the episode. And with this, we come to the end, and I want to thank you once more to be on the show with me.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, no problem. See you around.
Farewell.
You can follow us on Twitter at @scraftspodcast. Visit our website, softwarecraftspodcast.com, or visit our page on LinkedIn. Please give us feedback.